This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Dazzling Heights by Catherine McGee, performed by Phoebe Stroll. Prologue. It would be several hours before the girl's body was found. It was late now, so late that it could once again be called early, that surreal, enchanted twilight hour between the end of a party and the unfurling of a new day. The hour when reality grows dim and hazy at the edges, when nearly anything seems possible. The girl floated face down in the water. Above her stretched a towering city, dotted with light like fireflies, each pinprick an individual person, a fragile speck of life. The moon gazed over it all impassively, like the eye of an ancient god. There was something deceptively peaceful about the scene. Water flowed around the girl in a serene, dark sheet, making it seem that she was merely resting. The tendrils of her hair framed her face in a soft cloud. The folds of her dress clung determinedly to her legs, as if to protect her from the pre-dawn chill. But the girl would never feel cold again. Her arm was outstretched, as though she were reaching for someone she loved, or maybe to ward off some unspoken danger, or maybe even in regret over something she had done. The girl had certainly made enough mistakes in her too short lifetime. But she couldn't have known that they would all come crashing down around her tonight. After all, no one goes to a party expecting to die. Mariel. 2 months earlier. Mariel Valconsuelo sat cross-legged on her quilted bedspread in her cramped bedroom on the tower's 103rd floor. There were countless people in every direction, separated from her by nothing but a few meters and a steel wall or two. Her mother in the kitchen, the group of children running down the hallway, her neighbors next door, their voices low and heated as they fought yet again. But Mariel might as well have been alone on Manhattan right now, for all the attention she gave them. She leaned forward, clutching her old stuffed bunny tight to her chest. The watery light of a poorly transmitted hollow played across her face, illuminating her sloping nose and prominent jaw, and her dark eyes, now brimming with tears. Before her flickered the image of a girl with red-gold hair and a piercing, gold-flecked gaze. A smile played around her lips, as if she knew a million secrets that no one could ever guess, which she probably did. In the corner of the image, a tiny white logo spelled out, International Times Obituaries. "Today we mourn the loss of heiress Dodd Radson," began the obituary's voiceover, narrated by heiress's favorite young actress. Mariel wondered what absurd sum Mr. Radson had paid for that. The actress's tone was far too perky for the subject matter. She could just as easily have been discussing her favorite workout routine. "Heiress was taken from us in a tragic accident. She was only 17. Tragic accident. That's all you have to say when a young woman falls from the roof under suspicious circumstances? Heiress's parents probably just wanted people to know that Heiress hadn't jumped. As if anyone who'd met her could possibly think that. Mariel had watched this obit video countless times since it came out last month. By now, she knew the words by heart. Oh, she still hated it. The video was too slick, too carefully produced, and she knew most of it was a lie. But she had little else by which to remember Heiress. So Mariel hugged her ratty old toy to her chest and kept on torturing herself, watching the video of her girlfriend who had died too young. The hollow shifted to video clips of Heiress at different ages, a toddler, dancing in a magnelectric tutu that lit up a bright neon, a little girl on bright yellow skis cutting down a mountain, a teenager on vacation with her parents at a fabulous sun-drenched beach. No one had ever given Mariel a tutu. The only times she'd been in snow were when she ventured out to the burrows or the public terraces down here on the lower floors. Her life was so drastically different from Eris's, yet when they'd been together, none of that had seemed to matter at all. Eris is survived by her two beloved parents, Caroline Dodd and Everett Radson, as well as her aunt, Lane Arnold, uncle, Ted Arnold, cousins Matt and Sasha Arnold, and her paternal grandmother, Peggy Radson. No mention of her girlfriend, Mariel Valconsuelo. And Mariel was the only one of that whole sorry lot, aside from Eris's mom, who had truly loved her. The memorial service will be held this Tuesday, November 1st, at St. Martin's Episcopal Church, on floor 947. The hollow actress went on, finally managing a slightly more somber tone. Mariel had attended that service. She had stood in the back of the church, holding a rosary, trying not to break out into a scream at the sight of the coffin near the altar. It was so unforgivingly final. The vid swept to a candid shot of Eris on a bench at school, her legs crossed neatly under her plaid uniform skirt. Her head tipped back in laughter. Contributions in memory of Eris can be made to the Berkeley School's new scholarship fund, the Eris Dodd Radson Memorial Award, for underprivileged students with special qualifying circumstances. Qualifying circumstances. Mariel wondered if being in love with the dead scholarship honoree counted as a qualifying circumstance. God, she had half a mind to apply for the scholarship herself, just to prove how screwed up these people were beneath the gloss of their money and privilege. Eris would have found the scholarship laughable, given that she'd never shown even a slight interest in school. A prom drive would have been much more her style. There was nothing Eris loved more than a fun, sparkly dress, except maybe the shoes to match. Mariel leaned forward and reached out a hand as if to touch the hollow. The final few seconds of the obit were more footage of Eris laughing with her friends, that blonde named Avery, and a few other girls whose names Mariel couldn't remember. She loved this part of the vid, because Eris seemed so happy, yet she resented it because she wasn't part of it. The production company's logo scrolled quickly across the final image, and then the hollow dimmed. There it was, the official story of Eris's life, stamped with a damned International Times seal of approval, and Mariel was nowhere to be seen. She'd been quietly erased from the narrative, as if Eris had never even met her at all. A silent tear slid down her cheek at the thought. Mariel was terrified of forgetting the only girl she'd ever loved. Already she'd woken up in the middle of the night, panicked that she could no longer visualize the exact way Eris's mouth used to lift in a smile, or the eager snap of her fingers when she just thought of some new idea. It was why Mariel kept watching this vid. She couldn't let go of her last link to Eris forever. She sank back into her pillows and began to recite a prayer. Normally, praying calmed Mariel, soothed the frayed edges of her mind. But today she felt scattered. Her thoughts kept jumping every which way, slippery and quick like hovers moving down an expressway, and she couldn't pin down a single one of them. Maybe she would read the Bible instead. She reached for her tablet and opened the text, clicking the blue wheel that would open a randomized verse, and blinked in shock at the location it spun her to. The Book of Deuteronomy. You shall not show pity, but rather demand an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, burn for burn, wound for wound. For this is the vengeance of the Lord. Mariel leaned forward, her hands closing tight around the edges of the tablet. Eris's death wasn't a drunken accident. She knew it with a primal, visceral certainty. Eris hadn't even been drinking that night. She had told Mariel that she needed to do something to help out a friend, as she'd put it. And then, for some inexplicable reason, she'd gone up to the roof above Avery Fuller's apartment. And Mariel never saw her again. What had really happened in that cold, thin air, so impossibly high? Mariel knew there were ostensibly eyewitnesses, corroborating the official story that Eris was drunk and slipped off the edge to her death. But who were these eyewitnesses anyway? One was surely Avery, but how many others were there? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The phrase kept echoing in her mind like cymbals. A fall for a fall, a voice inside her added. Lita.
What room setting would you prefer today, Lita?
Lita Cole knew better than to roll her eyes. She just perched there, ramrod straight on the taupe psychology couch, which she refused to lie back on no matter how many times Dr. Vandersteen invited her to. He was deluded if he thought reclining would encourage her to open up to him. This is fine. Lita flicked her wrist to close the holographic window that had opened before her, displaying dozens of decor options for the color-shifting walls, a British rose garden, a hot Saharan desert, a cozy library. Leaving the room in this bland base setting, with beige walls and a vomit-colored carpet. She knew this was probably a test she kept on failing, but she derived a sick joy from forcing the doctor to spend an hour in this depressing space with her. If she had to suffer through this appointment, then so did he. As usual, he didn't comment on her decision.
"How are you feeling?" he asked instead.
"You want to know how I'm feeling?" Lita thought furiously. For starters, she'd been betrayed by her best friend and the only boy she'd ever really cared about. The boy she'd lost her virginity to. Now the two of them were together, even though they were adopted siblings. On top of that, she'd caught her dad cheating on her mom with one of her classmates. Lita couldn't bring herself to call Eris a friend. Oh, and then Eris had died because Lita had accidentally pushed her from the roof of the tower. "I'm fine," she said briskly. She knew she'd have to offer up something more expansive than fine if she wanted to get out of this session easily. Lita had been to rehab. She'd learned the scripts. She took a deep breath and tried again. "What I mean is, I'm recovering, given the circumstances. It's not easy, but I'm grateful to have the support of my friends." Not that Lita actually cared about any of her friends right now. She'd learned the hard way that none of them could be trusted.
"Have you and Avery spoken about what happened? I know she was up there with you when Eris fell."
"Yes, Avery and I talk about it," Lita interrupted quickly.
"Like hell we do.
Avery Fuller, her so-called best friend, had proved to be the worst of them all. But Lita didn't like hearing it spoken aloud, what had happened to Eris.
"And that helps?"
"It does." Lita waited for Dr. Vandersteen to ask another question, but he was frowning, his eyes focused on the near distance as he studied some projection that only he could see. She felt a sudden twist of nausea. What if the doctor was using a lie detector on her? Just because she couldn't see them didn't mean this room wasn't equipped with countless vitals scanners. Even now he might be tracking her heart rate or blood pressure, which were probably spiking like crazy. The doctor gave a weary sigh.
"Lita, I've been seeing you ever since your friend died, and we haven't gotten anywhere. What do you think it will take for you to feel better?"
"I do feel better," Lita protested. "All thanks to you." She gave Vandersteen a weak smile,
but he wasn't buying it.
"I see you aren't taking your meds," he said, changing tack.
Lita bit her lip. She hadn't taken anything in the last month, not a single Zenperhydrin or mood stabilizer, not even a sleeping pill. She didn't trust herself on anything artificial after what had happened on the roof. Eris might have been a gold-digging, home-wrecking whore, but Lita had never meant to...
"No,"
she reminded herself, clenching her hands into fists at her sides. "I didn't kill her. It was an accident. It's not my fault. It's not my fault." She kept repeating the phrase over and over, like the yoga mantras she used to chant at Silver Cove. If she repeated it enough, maybe it would become true. "I'm trying to recover on my own, given my history and everything." Lita hated bringing up rehab, but she was starting to feel cornered and didn't know what else to say. Vandersteen nodded with something that seemed like respect.
"I understand. But it's a big year for you, with college on the horizon, and I don't want this situation to adversely affect your academics."
"It's more than a situation," Lita thought bitterly.
"According to your room comp, you aren't sleeping well. I'm growing concerned,"
Vandersteen added.
"Since when are you monitoring my room comp?"
Lita cried out, momentarily forgetting her calm, unfazed tone. The doctor had the grace to look embarrassed.
"Just your sleep records," he said quickly. "Your parents signed off on it. I thought they had informed you."
Lita nodded curtly. She'd deal with her parents later. Just because she was still a minor didn't mean they could keep invading her privacy.
"I promise, I'm fine."
Vandersteen was silent again. Lita waited. What else could he do? Authorize her toilet to start tracking her urine the way the ones in rehab did? Well, he was welcome to it. He wouldn't find a damned thing. The doctor tapped a dispenser in the wall, and it spit out two small pills. They were a cheerful pink, the color of children's toys, or Lita's favorite cherry ice whip.
"This is an over-the-counter sleeping pill, lowest dose. Why don't you try it tonight if you can't fall asleep?"
He frowned, probably taking in the hollow circles around her eyes, the sharp angles of her face, even thinner than usual. He was right, of course. Lita wasn't sleeping well. She dreaded falling asleep, tried to stay awake as long as she could, because she knew the horrific nightmares that awaited her. Whenever she did drift off, she woke almost instantly in a cold sweat, tormented by memories of that night, of what she'd hidden from everyone.
"Sure!"
She snatched the pills and shoved them into her bag.
"I'd love for you to consider some of our other options, our light recognition treatment, or perhaps trauma reimmersion therapy."
"I highly doubt reliving the trauma will help, given what my trauma was,"
Lita snapped. She'd never bought into the theory that reliving your painful moments in virtual reality would help you move past them. And she didn't exactly want any machines creeping into her brain right now, in case they could somehow read the memory that lay buried there.
"What about your Dreamweaver?" the doctor persisted. "We could preload it with a few trigger memories of that night and see how your subconscious responds. You know that dreams are simply your deep brain matter making sense of everything that has happened to you, both joyful and painful."
He was saying something else, calling dreams the brain's safe space, but Lita was no longer listening. She had flashed to a memory of Eris in 9th grade, bragging that she'd broken through the Dreamweaver's parental controls to access the full suite of adult content dreams.
"There's even a celebrity setting," Eris had announced to her rapt audience with a knowing smirk.
Lita remembered how inadequate she'd felt,
hearing that Eris was immersed in steamy dreams about hollow stars, while Lita couldn't even imagine sex. She stood up abruptly.
We need to end this session early. I just remembered something I have to go take care of. See you next time.
She quickly stepped out the frosted flexiglass door of the Lions Clinic, perched high on the east side of the 833rd floor, just as her ear antennas began to chime a loud, brassy ringtone. Her mom. She shook her head to decline the incoming ping. Ilara would want to hear how the session had gone, would check that she was on her way home for dinner. But Lita wasn't ready for that kind of forced, upbeat normalcy right now. She needed a moment to herself, to quiet the thoughts and regrets chasing one another in a wild tumult through her head. She stepped onto the local sea lift and disembarked a few stops up tower. Soon she was standing before an enormous stone archway, which had been transported stone by stone from some old British university, carved with enormous block letters that read, "The Berkeley School." Lita breathed a sigh of relief as she walked through the arch and her contacts automatically shut off. Before Eris's death, she'd never realized how grateful she might feel for her high school's tech net. Her footsteps echoed in the silent halls. It was sort of eerie here at night, everything cast in dim, bluish-gray shadows. She moved faster, past the lily pond and athletic complex, all the way to the blue door at the edge of campus. Normally, this room was locked after hours, but Lita had school-wide access thanks to her position on student council. She stepped forward, letting the security system register her retinas, and the door swung obediently inward. She hadn't been in the observatory since her astronomy elective last spring. Yet it looked exactly as she remembered. A vast, circular room lined with telescopes, high-resolution screens, and cluttered data processors Lita had never learned to use. A geodesic dome soared overhead. And in the center of the floor lay the piece de resistance, a glittering patch of night. The observatory was one of the few places in the tower that protruded out past the floor below it. Lita had never understood how the school had gotten the zoning permits for it, but she was glad now that they had, because it meant they could build the oval eye, a concave oval in the floor, about 3 meters long and 2 meters wide, made of triple-reinforced flexiglass. A glimpse of how high they really were, up here near the top of the tower. Lita edged closer to the oval eye. It was dark down there, nothing but shadows, and a few stray lights bobbing in what she thought were the public gardens on the 50th floor. What the hell? She thought wildly, and stepped out onto the flexiglass. This sort of behavior was definitely off-limits, but Lita knew the structure would support her. She glanced down. Between her ballet flats was nothing but empty air, the impossible, endless space between her and the laminous darkness far below. This is what Eris saw when I pushed her, Lita thought, and despised herself. She sank down, not caring that there was nothing protecting her from a 2-mile fall except a few layers of fused carbon. Pulling her knees to her chest, she lowered her forehead and closed her eyes. A shaft of light sliced into the room. Lita's head shot up in panic. No one else had access to the observatory except the rest of the student council and the astronomy professors. What would she say to explain herself? Lita? Her heart sank as she realized who it was. What are you doing here, Avery? Same thing as you, I guess. Lita felt caught off guard. She hadn't been alone with Avery since that night, when Lita confronted Avery about being with Atlas, and Avery led her up onto the roof, and everything spun violently out of control. She wanted desperately to say something, but her mind had strangely frozen. What could she say, with all the secrets she and Avery had made together, buried together? After a moment, Lita was shocked to hear footsteps approaching.
as Avery walked over to sit on the opposite edge of the oval. "How did you get in?" she couldn't help asking. She wondered if Avery was still talking to Watt, the lower-floor hacker who'd helped Lita find out Avery's secret in the first place. Lita hadn't spoken to him since that night either. But with the quantum computer he was hiding, Watt could hack basically anything. Avery shrugged. "I asked the principal if I could have access to this room. It helps me, being here." Of course, Lita thought bitterly. She should have known it was as simple as that. Nothing was off-limits to the perfect Avery Fuller. "I miss her too, you know," Avery said quietly. Lita looked down into the silent vastness of the night to protect herself from what she saw in Avery's eyes. "What happened that night, Lita?" Avery whispered. "What were you on?" Lita thought of all the various pills she'd popped that day, as she'd sunk ever deeper into a hot, angry maelstrom of regret. "It was a rough day for me. I learned the truth about a lot of people that day. People I had trusted. People who used me," she said at last, and was perversely pleased to see Avery wince. "I'm sorry," Avery told her. "But, Lita, please, talk to me." More than anything, Lita wanted to tell Avery all of it. How Lita had caught her cheating scumbag of a father having an affair with Eris, and how awful she'd felt, realizing that Atlas had only ever slept with her in a fucked-up attempt to forget Avery. How she'd had to drug Watt to uncover that particular grain of truth. But the thing about the truth was that once you learned it, it became impossible to unlearn. No matter how many pills Lita popped, it was still there, lurking in the corners of her mind like an unwanted guest. There weren't enough pills in the world to make it go away. So Lita had confronted Avery, screamed at her atop the roof, without fully knowing what she was saying, feeling disoriented and dizzy in the oxygen-thin air. Then Eris had come up the stairs and told Lita she was sorry. As if a fucking apology would fix the damage she'd done to Lita's family. Why had Eris kept walking toward her even when Lita had told her to stop? It wasn't Lita's fault that she'd tried to push Eris away. She had just pushed too hard. All Lita wanted now was to confess everything to her best friend, to let herself cry about it like a child. But stubborn, sticky pride muffled the words in her throat, kept her eyes narrowed and her head held high. "You wouldn't understand," she said wearily. What did it matter anyway? Eris was already gone. "Then help me understand. We don't have to be this way, Lita, threatening each other like this. Why won't you just tell everyone it was an accident? I know you never meant to hurt her." They were the same words she'd thought to herself so many times. Yet hearing them spoken by Avery wakened a cold panic that grasped at Lita like a fist. Avery didn't get it, because everything came so easily to her. But Lita knew what would happen if she tried to tell the truth. There would probably be an investigation and a trial, all made worse by the fact that Lita had tried to cover it up. And the fact that Eris had been sleeping with Lita's dad would inevitably come to light. It would put Lita's family, her mom, through hell. And Lita wasn't stupid. She knew that looked like a damned convincing motive for pushing Eris to her death. What right did Avery think she had anyway, gliding in here and granting absolution like some kind of goddess? "Don't you dare tell anyone. If you tell, I swear you'll be sorry." The threat fell angrily into the silence. It seemed to Lita that the room had grown several degrees colder. She scrambled to her feet, suddenly desperate to leave. As she stepped from the oval eye onto the carpet, Lita felt something fall out of her bag. The two bright pink sleeping pills. Glad to see some things haven't changed. Avery's voice was utterly flat. Lita didn't bother telling her how wrong she was. Avery would always see the world the way she wanted to. At the doorway, she paused to glance back. Avery had slid to kneel in the middle of the oval eye, her hands pressed against the plexiglass surface, her gaze focused on some point far below. There was something morbid and futile about it, as if she were kneeling there in prayer, trying to bring Eris back to life. It took Lita a moment to realize that Avery was crying. She had to be the only girl in the world who somehow became more beautiful when she cried. Her eyes turning an even brighter blue, the tears on her cheeks magnifying the startling perfection of her face. And just like that, Lita remembered all the reasons she resented Avery. She turned away, leaving her former best friend to weep alone on a tiny fragment of sky. Calliope. The girl studied her reflection in the floor-length smart mirrors that lined the walls, lifting her mouth in a narrow red smile of approval. She wore a navy romper that was at least 3 years out of fashion, but deliberately so. She loved watching the other women in the hotel shoot envious glances toward her long, tanned legs. The girl tossed her hair, knowing the warm gold of her earrings brought out her caramel highlights, and fluttered her false lashes. Not the implanted kind, but real organic ones, grown from her own eyelids after a long and painful genetic repair procedure in Switzerland. It all exuded a tousled, effortless, glamorous sort of sexiness. Very Calliope Brown, the girl thought, with a frisson of pleasure.
I'm Elise on this one. You?
Her mom asked, as if reading her mind. She had dark blonde hair and artificially smooth, creamy skin, making her seem ageless. No one who saw the pair of them was ever quite sure whether she was the mother or the more experienced older sister.
I was thinking Calliope.
The girl shrugged into the name as if into an old, comfortable sweater. Calliope Brown had always been one of her favorite aliases, and it felt somehow fitting for New York. Her mom nodded.
I do love that one, even if it's always impossible to remember. It sounds like it's got spunk.
You could call me Callie,
Calliope offered, and her mom nodded absently, though they both knew she would just call Calliope by endearments. She'd said the wrong alias once, and it ruined everything. She'd been paranoid about making the same mistake ever since. Calliope glanced around the expensive hotel, taking in its plush couches, lit with gold and blue strands that matched the hue of the sky, clumps of business people muttering verbal commands to their contact lenses, the telltale shimmer in the corner that meant a security cam was watching. She stifled an urge to wink at it. Without warning, the toe of her shoe caught on something, and Calliope crashed violently to the ground. She landed on one hip, barely catching herself on her wrists, feeling the skin of her palms burn a little with the impact.
Oh my God!
Elise's legs folded beneath her as she knelt beside her daughter. Calliope let out a moan, which wasn't difficult given how much actual pain she was in. Her head pounded angrily. She wondered if the heels of her stilettos were totally scuffed. Her mom gave her a shake and she moaned harder, tears welling in her eyes.
Is she okay?
It was a boy's voice. Calliope dared tilt her head enough to peer at him through half-lidded eyes. He had to be a front desk attendant, with his clean-shaven face and the bright blue name hollow on his chest. Calliope had been to enough five-star hotels to know that the important people didn't advertise their names. Her pain was already subsiding, but still,
Calliope couldn't resist moaning a little louder and pulling one knee up to her chest just to show off her legs. She was gratified by the mingled flash of attraction and confusion, almost panic, that darted across the boy's face.
"Of course she's not okay! Where's your manager?"
Elise snapped. Calliope stayed quiet. She liked letting her mom do the talking when they were first laying the groundwork. And anyway, she was supposed to be injured.
"I'm sorry, I'll call him," the boy stammered.
Calliope gave a little whimper for good measure, though it wasn't necessary. She could feel the attention of everyone in the lobby shifting toward them, a crowd beginning to gather. Nervousness clung to the front desk boy like a bad perfume.
"I'm Oscar, the manager. What happened here?"
An overweight man in a simple dark suit trotted over. Calliope noted with delight that his shoes looked expensive.
"What's going on is that my daughter fell in your lobby because of that spilled drink."
Elise pointed to a puddle on the floor, complete with a lost-looking lime wedge.
"Don't you invest in a maid service here?"
"My sincerest apologies. I can assure you nothing like this has ever happened before, Mrs....
Ms. Brown," Elise sniffed.
"My daughter and I had planned on staying here for a week, but I'm no longer sure we want to."
She bent down a little lower.
"Can you move, honey?"
That was her cue.
"It really hurts,"
Calliope gasped, shaking her head. A single tear ran down her cheek, ruining her otherwise perfectly made-up face. She heard the crowd murmur in sympathy.
"Let me take care of everything," Oscar pleaded, turning bright red with anxiety. "I insist. Your room, of course, is complimentary."
15 minutes later, Calliope and her mom were firmly ensconced in a corner suite. Calliope stayed in bed, her ankle propped on a tiny triangle of pillows, holding perfectly still as the bellmen unloaded their bags. She kept her eyes closed even after she heard the front door shut behind him, waiting till her mom's footsteps turned back toward her bedroom.
"All clear now, sweetie," Elise called out.
She stood up in a fluid motion, letting the tower of pillows tumble to the ground.
"Seriously, Mum, you tripped me without warning."
"I'm sorry, but you know you've always been terrible at a fake fall. Your instincts for self-preservation are simply too strong,"
Elise replied from the closet, where she was already sorting her vast array of gowns in their color-coded transport bags.
"How can I make it up to you?"
"Cheesecake would be a good start."
Calliope reached past her mom for the fluffy white robe that hung on the door, emblazoned with a blue N and a tiny image of a cloud on the front pocket. She pulled it around her, letting the threads of the tie instantly weave themselves shut.
"How about cheesecake and wine?"
Elise made a few brisk motions with her hands to call up holographic images of the room service menu, pointing at various screens to order salmon, cheesecake, a bottle of Sancerre. The wine popped into their room in a matter of seconds, propelled by the hotel's temperature-controlled air tube system.
"I love you, sweetie. Sorry again for flinging you on your face."
"I know. It's just the cost of doing business,"
Calliope conceded with a shrug. Her mom poured them two glasses and clinked hers to Calliope's.
"Here's to this time."
"Here's to this time,"
Calliope echoed with a smile, as the words sent a familiar shiver of excitement up her spine. It was the same phrase she and her mom always used when they arrived somewhere new, and there was nothing Calliope loved more than starting somewhere new. She headed into the living room, to the curved flexiglass windows that lined the corner of the building, with dramatic views over Brooklyn and the dark ribbon of the East River. A few shadows that must have been boats still danced across its surface. Evening had settled over the city, softening the edges of it all. Scattered flecks of light blinked like forgotten stars.
"So this is New York," Calliope mused aloud.
after years of traipsing the world with her mom, standing at similar windows in so many luxury hotels and looking out over so many cities, the neon grid of Tokyo, the cheerful and vibrant disorder of Rio, the domed skyscrapers of Mumbai gleaming like bones in the moonlight. She had come to New York at last. New York, the first of the great super towers, the original sky city. Already Calliope felt a burst of tenderness toward it.
"Gorgeous view," Elise said, coming to join her.
"It almost reminds me of the one from London Bridge."
Calliope stopped rubbing her eyes, which were still a bit itchy from the latest retinal transfer, and glanced sharply at her mom. They rarely spoke of their old life before. Yet Elise didn't pursue the subject. She sipped her wine, her eyes fixed somewhere on the horizon. Elise was so beautiful, Calliope thought. But there was something hard and a little bit plasticky about her beauty now, the result of the various surges she'd had to change her appearance and go unrecognized each time they moved somewhere new.
"I'm doing this for us," she always told Calliope. "And for you, so you don't have to. At least not yet."
She never made Calliope play more than a supporting role in any of her cons. For the past 7 years, ever since they'd left London, Calliope and her mom had moved constantly from place to place. They never stayed anywhere long enough to get caught. The pattern was the same in each city. They would trick their way into the most expensive hotel in the most expensive neighborhood and scout the scene for a few days. Then Elise would pick her mark, someone with too much money for his or her own good, and just enough foolishness to believe whatever story Elise decided to tell. By the time the mark realized what had happened, Elise and Calliope were always long gone. Calliope knew that some people would call the pair of them cheats or con artists or swindlers. She preferred to think of them as very clever, very charming women who'd figured out how to level the playing field. After all, as Calliope's mom always said, rich people get free things all the time. Why shouldn't they, too?
"Before I forget, this is for you. I just uploaded it with the name Calliope Ellison Brown. That's what you wanted, right?"
Her mom handed her a shining new wrist computer. "Here lies Gemma Newberry, beloved thief," Calliope thought in delight, burying her most recent alias with a silent flourish. "She was as shameless as she was beautiful." She had a terribly morbid habit of composing epitaphs each time she set aside an identity, though she never shared them with her mom. She had a feeling that Elise wouldn't find them quite so amusing. Calliope tapped at the new wrist computer, pulling up her list of contacts, empty as usual, and noticed to her surprise that there wasn't a school registration listed.
"You're not making me go to high school for this one."
Elise shrugged.
"You're 18. Do you want to keep going to school?"
Calliope hesitated. She'd gone to school so many times, playing whatever role their particular scheme cast her in, a long-lost heiress, or a victim of some conspiracy, or occasionally just as Elise's daughter, when Elise needed a daughter to seem attractive to some victim. She had attended a preppy British boarding school and a French convent and a pristine public school in Singapore, and had rolled her eyes in sheer boredom at each one. Which was how Calliope had ended up running a few cons of her own. They were never as big as Elise's cons, which netted their real payout. But Calliope liked to do something on the side if she saw an opportunity. Elise was fine with it, as long as Calliope's projects didn't impede her ability to help out her mom whenever she was called upon. "It's good for you to get some practice," Elise always said, and let Calliope keep everything she earned herself, which supplemented her wardrobe quite nicely. Usually Calliope tried to gain the interest of a wealthy teenager, then conned him into buying her a necklace, or a new handbag, or the latest Robbie Lim suede boots. On a few rare occasions, she'd managed to get BitBank payments, not gifts, by pretending to be in serious trouble, or by finding out people's secrets and blackmailing them. Calliope had learned through the years that rich people did a lot of things they would rather keep buried. She briefly considered going to high school, doing the same thing as usual, but she quickly dismissed the idea. This time, she would go bigger. Oh, there were so many ways to hook a mark. The accidental run-in, the sidelong glance, the nuanced smile, the flirtation, the confrontation, the accident. And Calliope was an expert in all of them. She'd closed out every con she'd ever started. Except Travis. The one mark who'd ever left Calliope, rather than the other way around. She'd never figured out why, and it still nettled her, just a little. But he was just one person, and there were millions here. Calliope thought of all the crowds she'd seen earlier, streaming in and out of elevators, rushing home or to work or to school. All of them preoccupied with their own small worries, clutching at their impossible dreams. None of them even knew she existed. And if they did know, they wouldn't care. But that was what made this game fun. Because Calliope was about to make one of them care very much. She felt a bright, glorious, reckless rush of anticipation. She couldn't wait to find her next mark. Avery Fuller wrapped her arms tighter around herself. The wind tore at her hair, yanking it into an unruly blonde tangle, whipping the folds of her dress around her like a banner. A few droplets of rain began to fall. They stung lightly where they touched her bare skin. But Avery wasn't ready to leave the roof. This was her secret place, where she retreated when all the furious lights and sounds down there, in the rest of the city, became too much to bear. She looked out to the hazy purple of the horizon, which stretched into a deep, fathomless black overhead. She loved the way she felt up here, aloof and alone and safe with her secrets. It's not safe, a nagging feeling told her, as a pair of footsteps sounded. Avery turned around, nervous, and broke into a smile when she saw that it was Atlas. But the trapdoor flung open again, and suddenly Lita was there, her face suffused with anger. She looked thin and drawn and dangerous. She wore her very skin as if it were armor. "What do you want, Lita?" Avery asked warily, though she didn't really need to ask. She knew what Lita wanted. She wanted to break her and Atlas apart, and Atlas was the one thing Avery would never, ever give up. She took a step in front of him as if to protect him. Lita caught the gesture. "How dare you!" she spat, and reached out to shove Avery. Avery's stomach lurched, her arms wheeling as she tried desperately to cling to something, but it was all too far away, even Atlas, and the world had devolved into a blur of color and sound and screaming, the ground hurtling ever faster toward her. She sat up abruptly, a cold sheen of sweat on her brow. It took her a moment to recognize the dim bulkiness of her surroundings as the furniture in Atlas's bedroom.
"Aves?" Atlas murmured. "You okay?"
She curled her knees to her chest, trying to slow the erratic beating of her heart. "Just a nightmare," she told him. Atlas pulled her close and wrapped his arms tightly around her from behind, so that she was safe in the warm circle of his embrace.
"Do you want to talk about it?"
Avery did want to talk about it, except she couldn't. So she turned around to silence him with a kiss. She'd been sneaking over to Atlas's room every night since Eris died. She knew she was playing with fire. But being with the boy she loved, talking to him, kissing him, just inhaling his presence, was the only thing that kept Avery from spinning off the edge lately. And even here, with Atlas, she wasn't wholly safe from herself, She hated the web of secrets that kept tightening around her, driving an invisible wedge between them, though Atlas had no idea. He didn't know about the delicate balancing act Avery now found herself in with Leda. A secret for a secret. Leda knew about them, and the only reason she hadn't blasted it to the world was that Avery had seen her push Eris up on the roof that night. Now Avery was hiding the truth about Eris's death under threat from Leda. She couldn't bring herself to tell Atlas about it all. The knowledge would only hurt him, and the truth was, Avery didn't want him to learn what had really happened that night. If he knew what she'd done, he might not look at her this way anymore, with such blinding love and devotion. She wrapped her fingers tighter in the curls at the base of Atlas's neck, wanting to stop time, to disappear into this moment and live in it forever. When Atlas finally pulled away, she felt his smile, even if she couldn't see it. No scary dreams anymore. Not while I'm here. I'll keep them away, I promise.
I dreamed that I lost you, she blurted out, a note of trepidation threading through her voice.
Now that they were together, against all odds, losing Atlas was her greatest fear.
Avery.
He put a finger under her chin and gently lifted it so that she was looking into his eyes.
I love you. I'm not going anywhere.
I know, she replied, and she knew that he meant it. But there were so many obstacles in their path, so many forces stacked against them, that at times it all felt insurmountable.
She lay back down in the soft, warm space next to his body, but her thoughts were still scattered. She felt like she was coiled too tightly and couldn't be unwound.
"Do you ever wish another family had adopted you?"
she whispered, voicing a thought she'd had countless times. If he'd ended up with some other family, if some other boy had grown up as her adopted brother, then Atlas wouldn't be forbidden. She wondered what it would have been like, meeting him in school or at some party, bringing him home to meet the Fullers. It would all be so much easier.
Of course not,
Atlas said, startling her with the vehemence of his tone.
Aves, if I'd been adopted by a different family, I might never have met you.
Maybe, she trailed off, but she couldn't help thinking that she and Atlas were inevitable. The universe would have conspired for them to meet some way or another, pulling them together with a gravitational force that was all their own.
Maybe, Atlas conceded. But that's not a risk I'm willing to take. You're the most important thing in the world to me. The day your parents brought me home, the day I first met you, was the second best day of my life.
Oh, really? And what was the best day? She asked with a smile. She expected Atlas to say that the best day was when they confessed their love for each other. But he surprised her. Today, he said simply, which will only last until tomorrow, and then tomorrow will be the best day. Because every day with you is better than the one before. He leaned over to kiss her lightly, just as a knock sounded on the door.
Atlas?
For a terrible instant, every cell in Avery's body was frozen. She looked up at Atlas and saw her own terror reflected on his handsome face. His door was locked, but here, like everywhere in the apartment, Mr. and Mrs. Fuller had the ability to override.
"One second, Dad!"
Atlas called out, a little too loudly. Avery stumbled out of bed, wearing her ivory satin shorts and a bra, and stumbled breathlessly toward Atlas's closet. Her bare feet nearly tripped over a shoe as she ran. She had just managed to pull the door shut behind her when Pearson Fuller strode into his adopted son's room. The overhead lights flicked on with his steps.
"Everything okay in here?"
Did she hear a note of suspicion in her dad's voice, or was she imagining it?
What's going on, Dad?
Typical Atlas, answering a question with a question. But it was a good deflective technique.
I just heard back from Jean-Pierre Leclos in the Paris office,
Avery's dad said slowly.
It looks like the French might finally let us build something next to that antique eyesore of theirs.
His form was just visible through the slats of the closet door. Avery stayed utterly still, pressing back into a gray wool coat, her arms crossed over her chest. Her heart was pounding so erratically she felt certain her dad would hear it. Atlas's closet was much smaller than hers. There was nowhere to hide if Pearson came to open the door. There was no possible explanation for why she would be here, wearing a bra and pajama shorts in Atlas's room, except, of course, for the real reason. Out there in the bedroom, her pink shirt lay on the floor like a glaring searchlight.
Okay,
Atlas replied, and Avery heard the unspoken query. Why was their dad coming over in the middle of the night for something that didn't sound particularly urgent? After what was surely too long a silence, Pearson cleared his throat.
You'll have to come early to the development meeting tomorrow. We're going to need to do a full analysis of their streets and waterways to start prepping.
I'll be there, Atlas said tersely. He was standing directly on top of the shirt, trying to discreetly cover it with one of his feet. Avery willed her dad not to notice the movement.
Sounds good.
A moment later, Avery heard the door to her brother's room click shut. She leaned back and slid helplessly down the wall to a seated position. It felt like tiny needles were prickling all over her skin, like that time she'd been vitamin checked at the doctor, except laced with adrenaline. She felt restless and reckless and strangely exhilarated, as if she'd tripped into quicksand and somehow emerged on the other side unharmed. Atlas flung open the closet.
You okay, Aves?
The closet lights turned on as he opened the doors, but for an impossibly brief instant, Avery was in the dark while Atlas seemed illuminated from behind. Light streaming around him, gilding the edges of his form, making him seem almost otherworldly. It seemed suddenly impossible that he was real and here and hers. And in truth, it was impossible. Everything about their relationship kept proving impossible at every turn, yet somehow they had willed it into being. I'm fine. She stood up to run her hands up his arms, settling them finally on his shoulders. But he took a reflexive step back and reached for her top, which still lay there on the ground.
That was not good, Aves.
Atlas held out the shirt, his features creased with worry. He didn't see me, Avery argued, but she knew that wasn't the point. Neither of them mentioned what their dad might have already seen. Avery's bedroom, on the other side of the apartment, her pristine white bed covers rumpled but decidedly empty.
We need to be more careful.
Atlas sounded resigned. Avery pulled her shirt over her head and looked up at him, her chest constricting at what he wasn't saying. There's no more sleeping over, is there? She asked, though she already knew the answer. They couldn't risk it. Not anymore.
No. Aves, you need to go.
I will. Starting tomorrow, she promised, and pulled his mouth to hers. Now, more than ever, Avery knew how dangerous it was, but that just made each moment with Atlas infinitely more precious. She knew the risks. She knew they were walking a tightrope, that it would be so, so easy to fall. If this was their last night sleeping over, then she was going to make it count. She wished she could tell him everything, but instead she willed it all into her kisses. All the silent apologies, the confessions, the promises to love him forever. If she couldn't tell him aloud, there was no other way to tell him than this.